Well, my thankfulness and apologies to those of you who got here on time and early and were up on the balcony and I kicked you out. We have plenty of people come, and that's why those folks up there in the balcony dark. Good to see everybody here today. As I mentioned here earlier, this was an invitation-only event. We've made a strategic decision not to broadcast it to everybody in the church. Not that there's anything that's happening here tonight that we wouldn't want everybody to hear, but we just felt like the stuff we want to talk about tonight is most helpful for those of us who are exhibiting the characteristics of family. And that's what we have in here tonight. People who are exhibiting the characteristics of being on the team. You're serving, you're significantly giving, you understand the vision of this place. And we wanted a time to be able to talk about some things that are happening in our midst and give you a sneak peek at that. And sort of the closeness and the fewness of our numbers, relatively speaking, is a pretty cool thing. We're going to do communion at the end of our night tonight. And let me give you some thoughts about communion right now. This comes from the book of Mark, chapter 14. And it's when Jesus is around with his team. And he says, Jesus takes the bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to his disciples, saying, "Take it, this is my body." Then he took the cup when he had given thanks, and he gave it to them, and they all drank from it. "This is the blood of the covenant which is poured out for many," he said. "Truly I tell you, I will not drink again of the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God." And he's saying that I'm going to break myself. I'm going to break myself open on a cross. I'm going to spill my blood down on the cross. And it's going to be for the forgiveness of all people who receive me. And people have been doing this for thousands of years. In our current cultural context, most of the time it takes place in sort of a church building structure. But for the first several hundred years, they understood every meal to be communion. Whenever I had a meal and I was with somebody who had received Christ, we just remember and thank God for the way he's broken us as we have this BLT sandwich or as we have this pizza or whatever it was. And then at some point along the line, it got institutionalized to where only people who went to seminary could administer it. And it's just been an unusual thing as it's progressed over the last few hundred years. We made a decision earlier on in the year to not have regular next levels for a variety of reasons. And we were going to put communion, have it, make sure people were doing it in small groups, doing it in their homes, and occasionally on the weekends. And we just are learning that it's good to have a more regular, consistent rhythm than that in our cultural context, even though biblically speaking, it's best, I believe, and wonderful when people just have it in their homes with their other Christ followers. But this is one of the things that we're learning and we're trying to experiment with, and we're just talking about that as family. We don't have everything here figured out, and we're trying to try new things and do new things, and we never just want to stop and say, well, we've always done communion this way, so we're never going to try anything different. We've been trying it a certain way for the last several years, and we tried something different the last few months. We realized we need to try something different again. So we're not sure exactly what we're going to try. We are going to try something different again, but tonight we are going to have communion later. And what's special about when we have communion here is that we know that we're all here on the same team. We don't have a bunch of people in here who just like to go to church services and sit in the back pews and watch things. We have everybody here tonight that wants to be on the team, that wants to break themselves. In some way, shape, or form, everyone in here tonight, you've broken yourself or you've spilled yourself for the vision that God has for our community. And for that, I just want to say thank you for coming out tonight, answering your email, answering your card, and being here. We're hoping that you'll be thankful that you came. Well, I'm going to invite some people up on stage right now who are going to help me out here. So you know who you are. Bring your chairs up on stage. We had a staff meeting this last week, and I sat through that staff meeting, and I said, wow, this is great information that everybody who's really on the team at Crossroads would love to hear. And so we're going to have basically a larger staff meeting right now. We're going to talk about some things that are coming up, some things that are happening beneath or behind the curtain, and then also talk about what that's going to mean for our future this year and what it means for our consume journey that starts this week. So there's going to be, at some points here tonight, a lot of information you've never heard and you have to try to process. Some of you might have not heard any of this information before. Some of you are going to be sitting there going, wow, you know, I'd like to be inspired more. We'll get you inspired. But there's a lot of stuff that we just want you to kind of be in the know on. So just kind of sit back as we have a big staff meeting today. I've got over here on the right, Darren Yates, who's our executive pastor. Everyone say hello to Darren. Yeah. Yes. Tim Seneff, Tim Sendeff, who's our director of outreach. Say hello, Darren. Christine Buchholz, who works in our outreach area as well. Molly Cunningham, who was working on our multi-site strategy as well, and is the director of that. Darren is going to talk tonight. He's just come back from India. Tim has just come back recently from South Africa. Christine has just recently come back from the inner city of Cincinnati. And Molly has just recently come back from the northern suburbs of Cincinnati. And so we're going to talk about some things that are happening out there, and then I'm going to tell you why we're talking about those. So, Darren, tell us about what's going on.
Well,
and by the way, when I say executive pastor, Darren is basically the COO of the church. He does most of the day-to-day operations of the staff and the other logistics that are behind the scenes. So, you know, he is the heavy infrastructure muscles around here. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Brian's just a figurehead, actually.
That's right.
Just kidding. I didn't say that, did I?
Say that next.
You know, at some point, you cracked on me all Super Bowl, and now you're going to keep cracking me now. At what point do you not crack on me any longer?
All right, well, here's the deal with India. Globally, there are almost 2 million children.
I'm sorry.
I just stopped here.
Well, I do this in staff meetings. Let me stop.
Stop.
Let me tell you why we're going to do this right now. You know, you stay right there. This is an old metaphor we used years ago. I want to resurrect it. We're in right now in a building which is a foundation. It's a launching pad. It's a foundation upon which a lot of things have to happen. Sometimes we'll look at what's happened in the world and we think, man, I'd love to do stuff to help people get out of slavery. I'd love to do stuff to help the AIDS crisis and poverty on the other side of the world. I'd love to do stuff that's helping breaking poverty here in the nation. I'd love to be able to do stuff that's, or in the city. I'd love to be able to do stuff that's helping people come to know Christ that's outside of this immediate geographical area. How do I do all those things? And what we say is, all those things are the work of the church, and Crossroads, this 3,500 thing, is sort of the foundation upon which all of that stuff rests. And so we're going to talk about today the things that are sitting on that and also the foundation. So go ahead, Darren.
Can I speak now?
And we're going to go longer than an hour and 15 minutes if you haven't already figured that out. So go ahead.
Really longer, yes, if you keep going. But welcome to staff, guys. This is it. Well, here's the deal. As I said just a minute ago, there are almost 2 million children globally that are in slavery in the sex trade. And in India is one of the largest countries for children in the sex trade. Almost 25% of those kids are in India. And so we have a partnership with an organization named International Justice Mission. And they are all about bringing justice to those who are oppressed and those who are abused and those who can't seek justice on their own, in particular about these girls in India, primarily girls in India, that are oppressed in slavery in the sex trade. And they have been relatively successful, or actually very successful, at rescuing these girls. They've freed over 800 girls over the last 4 years. In fact, 200 last year. That's a global number. 64 of those girls that were rescued were in India. And so Christine and myself and a few others from Crossroads went over to Mumbai, India to visit with them and to see how we could support them in their mission of rescuing these girls, and in particular how to care for them afterwards. Now, since I've been back, as I've tried to describe the world that these people live in, I found that there's a lot of people that really don't understand India or haven't been there or don't understand the world that leads to this. So I put together some pictures and some stats for our staff to describe the situation. So why don't we pull up the first slide? You can tell that this is actually for staff. This is my simplistic model here. You know, if this were on the weekend, there would be motion all over the graphics, but this is behind the scenes. Mumbai is one of the most populated cities in the world. It's one of the top three, I believe, most populated cities in the world, with over 19 million people that live there. And compare that to Greater Cincinnati at just over 2 million people. When I say Greater Cincinnati, I'm talking Greater Cincinnati, 15 counties going all the way up to Middletown. And so that's a huge, huge area, about to almost 4,000 square miles, where Mumbai is about a quarter of that size. So when you do the math and do the people per square mile, go ahead and do that next slide. It's about 40 times as dense a city as the city of Cincinnati. If you look around here, there's about 2,000 people here. If you say spread out over our parking lot and say that's a comfortable distance, I feel good about this. You know, put 80,000 people there, and then you start getting the feeling about how congested it is. Go to the next slide. The other piece about Mumbai and about India is that it is an extremely poor country. The per capita income in Mumbai is about $1,200 per year compared to about $23,000 per year for Cincinnati. And again, Mumbai, that's a pretty big city. That's also the entertainment capital. It's the financial capital of India. This is the land of opportunity in India. Its per capita income is about three times the income of rural India or about other parts of India. So this is actually the wealthier part of India. But compare that, do the math to get to total income. Next slide, guys. It's about half the total amount of income for 10 times the number of people. You know, you think about it, take your salary, cut it in half, share it with 10 of your friends. That's the kind of poverty that folks are dealing with over in India. So let me show you some pictures of what that looks like. This is typical housing in India. I'm going to stand up so I can actually see the slides. The typical housing in India, multi-level flats. When you see any of these flats, you may see 15, 20 people living in one of these areas. And again, this is typical. This is middle class. In fact, that one was probably closer to upper middle class. But this is not where the typical people live. This is middle class. Next slide. 54% of people in Mumbai live in slums like this. It's enormous. Think about that. 54%, that's almost 10 million people live in these slums like this. It is literally put up a piece of stick, lean something up against it, and that's your home. Everything is there, dirt floors. You can also see the buildings in the back. There is money in Mumbai. In fact, a lot of money in Mumbai. It's just in the hands of very few people, and most of those people are foreigners. So you'll see these high-rise apartments or high-rise hotels that are just absolutely beautiful, but then in the shadows of them are just unbelievable slums. But again, this is not the poorest of the poor. These are the poorest of the poor. They call them pavement communities, concrete communities. And this is where you will see everywhere you look people living on the streets right next to you. Go back to the previous slide if you can. You see that over on the left where they've just cooked their breakfast, I believe. They're pouring out their food. This is their kitchen. This is their bathroom. This is their living room. This is their home. Now go through it. Kids everywhere. Most of the kids, you see this one doesn't have any pants on. Most of the kids either don't have pants on or don't have clothes on at all. They don't have diapers. Again, this is their bathroom. And so instead of messing up all of their clothes, they just go around naked, and wherever they go, they go. And what this does to us then, traffic is another piece. I mean, you can see this is just picture out of the van that we were in. This is typical Mumbai traffic. It is a hard city to live in. You can go about 5 or 6 miles an hour anywhere you go. And the joke that we had there is it takes 45 minutes to go anywhere. But the reality is it's, you know, sometimes we're driving 3 or 4 hours to go anywhere. They would just tell you it's 45 minutes. What you're left with is just a big, stinky, polluted, nasty, ugly town. It's just a hard, hard life. And so I show these pictures just to give you a flavor of where some people come from. And again, this is the land of opportunity. So most of the people that we're dealing with, these girls that are in the trade, are coming from rural India. So it's even lower on the scale than this. And so then you can start to understand. It's still hard. It's unfathomable. But you can start to understand how one could get to the point where selling a human for the sex trade makes sense. Or even worse yet, how you could even get to the point where you're desperate enough to feed the rest of your family that you would consider selling one of your girls. That's why I show these pictures. I'm going to show you a video right now. This is about This is from the red light district in Mumbai, and this is a tour that we took. So the video is very sketchy, and we're actually driving down the van with a camera out the window. This is in slow motion so that you actually don't get sick with looking at it. But you can start to see some of the girls back. This is basically just a brothel right there, right next to a beauty salon, across an alley, another brothel with the girls just hanging out. This is a business district. Think about this as, you know, when I started thinking about it, I'll describe this as a little bit when I see these pictures. These girls, then they see Tim, they run away. For obvious reasons. Some of the pictures. When I heard we were going to take a tour of the red light district, and I was imagining, Bourbon Street, Indian style. And you can stop that. And the reality is, this is on multiple locations in Mumbai. There's not one red light district. There's multiple red light districts. They're all over the place. And when you say red light districts, it's really just a neighborhood. This is a business district. You will have a convenience store, and then a fabric shop, and then a luggage store, and then a mosque, and then a brothel, and then the police station, and then another brothel, and then a church. It's just, think about Hyde Park Square. That's what it is. And this is just a business just like any other business. They don't have a sign up there, but, you know, they don't really need a sign. The girls with the sign out there. It is technically illegal, but the police will be right there with them, and they will not intervene unless there is proof that there are underage girls involved. And if there's proof that underage girls that are involved, then they'll start taking action. And so that's where IJM really does the bulk of the work. That's what they're known for. They put investigators and undercover operatives in these neighborhoods, and they search down information trying to find where these underage girls are. And if they can find enough information and enough proof that they can go to the police and convince the police to intervene, then with the police, they will go on a raid to these brothels, literally kick down doors, forcefully enter into these brothels, and will take these girls out. Most of these girls are fighting them the whole way. They don't know any better. This is the life that they know. And the fear of the unknown freedom is just way scarier to them than the known fear, the known evil that they live in. And so it's just a horrible, horrible life. IJM are heroes. They are risking their life on a daily basis for people who can't fight for themselves. And they literally go in there and they take these girls out. Where they go from there is government homes in India. There's actually two of them, one for underage girls and one for those over 18. It's majors and minors, what they call it. This is the one for minors. I only have one picture because we weren't really allowed to take pictures and we weren't really allowed to interact with the girls. I can only describe it as say we drove up in our van and you see concrete walls and barbed wire and broken glass on top of the walls. And a huge gate with guards, and we're blowing the horn. They come over and check the credentials to allow us in. Think of this as a prison. This is a prison. We go in, concrete floors, concrete walls, very, very stark existence. The kitchen is an open flame with a grate on top of it. They're very proud of this, partially because IJM has given them some of the money to make it nicer, which it is nicer, don't get me wrong, but man, it's still a prison. It is a prison. And these girls that are there, when we were there, there were 59 girls there, and one baby, toddler, a year and a half old. And they, two of the girls were pregnant. They had very just melancholy, stoic looks on their face. All of them were just distant, glassy-eyed kind of look. And you see the red light district, you see this existence, and you're saying, man, these girls are choosing between slavery and prison. It's just a horrible, horrible life. And what a choice that is. And I walked away from there saying, I don't see hope. Where's the hope in this? I just can't see it. And so I talked to some of the IJM people and said, do you have hope? And they say, well, yeah, we have hope because we have to. And okay. And so then we start visiting some of these other places, and I got to meet some of the girls that have been placed in aftercare by IJM in some different homes. And I started meeting girls like these. And they were just beautiful, wonderful girls.
These are girls that were in sex slavery.
These were in
sex slavery. Now are not in a government home, but they're in the IJM.
They're not in IJM homes, but they're in homes that IJM has placed them in.
Okay.
Different NGOs, non-government organizations run homes here. And these girls, you see the girls in the red light district and you look at them and we're driving down the street and we're saying, ah, this is disgusting. This is nasty. How could this happen? And you're like, oh, those are the girls we're trying to rescue. And then you see these girls and you say, wow, they're so beautiful and they're so joyful and they're so happy and they're just normal average teenagers. And you say, a year ago, these girls were in that world. And I said, what's the difference? Well, the difference, as we visited several different homes, I've never seen a more visible display of the power of love before in my life. These girls are loved. And where there's love, there's hope. And where there is love, there is joy. And I've never been able to see it like I saw it on this trip. I've got a video of some of these girls. Just look in their eyes. Just look at the hope in their eyes. Look at the joy in their eyes. Beautiful, beautiful girls. We sat in a circle with these girls, and they went around one by one and said what their name was and what their favorite food was, just through an interpreter, and we got all the way around, and they're just normal teenagers. You know, they're ranging in this house. I think it was 13 to 17. Went in the government home. They said 11 to 17. These are just young girls. And
based on what you've learned and what you see, what are we going to do?
What are we going to do is we need to provide aftercare and love on these girls and find ways to bring them out of hell and put them in a situation where they can be loved and they can be cared for, and then then we can provide opportunities for them, training, vocational opportunities for them to build a life. And so one of the things that that we're going to do is partner with IJM for this model aftercare. So let's go to the pictures. This is the model aftercare. Let's just flip through them as we go to the outside. Green grass. You know, you don't see that often. This is the kitchen, the bedroom, and this is my favorite picture. We provide that home. This home is beautiful, and the most important part of that home is those three ladies right there. They are just wonderful, loving ladies, and those are the ladies that will be responsible for loving on these girls. It's not open yet. They don't have a license yet. It will be open hopefully in the next couple of months. But these will be the ladies that are responsible for it. The one in the middle is Simran, a beautiful girl. We interacted with her. Doesn't speak much English. Simran was a sexually abused teenager in her home. Was sexually abused by her stepfather and her uncle, and ran away from home at the age of 15. When she ran away from home, she was able to find a job. She was able to make ends meet, but barely. And it was approached by a guy who said, "I've got an opportunity where we can put you to work, making five times as much as you do now, and you can learn computers and you can learn a skill and improve your life." So she got on a train with this guy and they head to Mumbai, and 2 days later they get off of the train, they go directly to a brothel, and she's sold to this brothel owner for $200. She fights, she puts up a resistance, she fights against this, and she's brutalized and she's raped and she's oppressed. And she continues to fight. She continues to fight. And ultimately, IJM hears word that there are some girls that are involved in this that don't want to be, and they put enough information together, and they raid this brothel, and they take out nine girls, five of which were minors, one of which was Simran. And Simran has now dedicated her life, after some recovery and healing, has dedicated her life to helping girls that came from backgrounds like hers. And so she is actually assistant manager in the model aftercare home.
So what are we going to do?
What are we going to do is we're going to try our best to raise the money to provide the operating cost for this model aftercare home, which is about $500,000. And we are going to try to provide opportunities for these girls to learn a trade or find vocations. And then beyond that, actually start enterprises here. We would like to put somebody on the ground in India, in Mumbai. It's very important to have infrastructure in place that can sustain the type of enterprise building that these girls can interact with and create opportunities so these girls can earn a living and improve their life.
Infrastructure, big word we're going to talk about tonight. Let's thank Darren. Let's thank him for what he's done there. Awesome.
Hey, one more thing before I forget. Hey, you guys want something to pray for? By the time you wake up in the morning, it'll be night in Mumbai. They have a raid planned tomorrow night in which they think that they can rescue 25 girls. So as you pray tonight, pray for them.
Pray for that right now, God. That's what we're praying for here. We're praying for that raid, that is successful and effective, that those 25 girls got out, and the people who are doing the raid are protected by your warrior angels. And we pray for being a part of the solution for what happens when girls like that then come out. We're ready. Amen. Tim.
South Africa. You know, talking future and vision is fun. I think to know where we're going, though, we need to know where we've come from. And so I want to tell you a little bit about that, because I'm not sure actually who I'm talking to here. Let me ask this. How many of you, show of hands, were here 4 years ago? All right. So maybe half or so. Well, for those of you who weren't, you may not know that the seats you're sitting in, they didn't exist. We were in a parking lot 4 years ago. And these church-wide journeys where we're getting other churches together to go on a journey like Consume, those didn't exist. And this partnership that I think has really revolutionized who Crossroads is and what we feel our calling in the kingdom to be with Titus and his church, Charity and Faith Mission in Mamelodi, South Africa, that literally didn't exist 4 years ago at all. 4 years ago, right about this time, Brian, I know you and Libby just got back from a visit there, and I know you were just struck by the AIDS and the poverty, and Brian came back and he said, we have to do something about this. And so through Crazy Campaign, that's when we funded an AIDS hospice over there, and that's what I would call chapter one. When we funded the hospice, and we said we want to be about that, and that was a good time. That was also a difficult time. That was a time when Titus and I got to know each other and we recognized that maybe there were some hurt feelings as we worked through the process and we didn't understand each other. There was some apartheid stuff that made interacting difficult, but we also really sought forgiveness from each other and it came out to be actually a really beautiful thing. We talked about that. From stage a couple years ago.
From your perspective, I said a couple weeks ago about the different models of partnership or the different things that American churches do. But I thought you had some really good perspective when you said to some folks recently about your background, your research, and how just the unique nature of what we're dealing with is.
Yeah, so you know, we started doing that check writing model that a lot of churches do, but we have since, after that time, said, let's get together and let's actually be engaged in a deep way relationship-wise. And that's when Go Mamelodi took off and Host Mamelodi happened. By the way, you guys saw the commercial, we're going back, Go Mamelodi. Come on, yeah. November. Two trips. We're also having Host Mamelodi come back in May. So they're going to come here and they're going to reach out with us during Go Cincinnati, hopefully bringing over 50 people, yeah. Which you can also clap yeah. for. So this going deep thing has been really cool. But yeah, just perspective wise, I've been doing this outreach church ministry thing for 9 years. I'm not like the expert on this, but I consider myself a student of this. And I know what a lot of churches are doing. And I got to tell you, I don't know of a single church and the United States that has the depth and breadth of a relationship with a church in a developing country like we do with Charity and Faith. And so literally every day we wake up, we are making this up as we go. We really are. We don't have anyone that we're going to school on. And so this is uncharted territory, and it's something that...
And people who don't, therefore, have never seen it, we get criticism for it because they've never seen it before.
We do. And so, yeah.
They don't understand. They're like trying to criticize us for being a dog when they're a cat. You know, it's just a different deal.
That's good. Huh. I can't make fun of my boss's boss twice in one
day. Yes, so. You can. You sure can.
No, so yeah, you had talked about, you know, there's this check writing model, and there's this, you know, another model called the one-stop drop, where churches oftentimes go in and do something, and then they leave, and they feel good, and they leave with the illusion that, hey, everything I did was great, and these gardens that I planted, now they flourish, and it's feeding the whole village. And these houses we built, you know, everybody, you know, all the light plate switches are on, and everybody is, you know, eating Thanksgiving meal, like smiling by candlelight. And here's the thing. Those churches don't go back to see that, yes, sometimes that's the case. Sometimes it's not. And so because we have been in this depth of relationship, which I call chapter 2, relationship, we have people who are going back and saying, yes, there's great stuff that's happening, but quite honestly, there's also some things that we are frustrated with, that we feel like we started and haven't been completed, that we feel like... you know, we may be set up and haven't been maintained the way we want to. And we just were on a trip, Brian and I, in January, where some docs and business professionals had some of these feelings. And the thing I got to say is this. This angst that we have around that, what we recognized when we were there is, that's the exact reason we need to be in relationship. Because, first of all, we need to chill out. We just need to loosen up and recognize that we say, oh man, if you don't have the spreadsheet and crunching numbers, then what's the deal with ministry? And they're saying, you have time to sit behind a computer and crunch numbers when there are people dying of AIDS? Would you actually do some stinking ministry? And so we need to hear that. We do. And they also need to hear that, you know what, we need to finish the last 10%. And we need to actually be taking things to the next level of sustainability and of infrastructure. And that's why we believe that the next chapter is going to be that. It's going to be infrastructure. It's going to be sustainability, where we say, hey, we want to continue sending people over and bringing people back and having these relationships together, but we want to do this in a smart way. And we want to do this in a way where real progress is being made in Mama Lodi. And so that's what we want to be about.
And this is something that we see as being a model that is going to actually sweep the country here and south and in Africa and go across the continent, of being able to hook up and actually have different outposts and things spread like this across that continent. That's the ultimate vision.
Yep. I get called all the time from people who say, I want the type of relationship at my church, pastors, with a church like Titus's. And so we want to replicate that throughout the continent of Africa and here. So what we think that could look like through consumed is, we think that we want to challenge people, and Brian will be talking a lot about this, to say no to consumerism, to say no to just following the American dream, but also say yes to what could happen in the kingdom of God. And in South Africa, that could look a lot of different ways, but what that's especially going to look like, because what Titus has told us he wants, is he wants some people on the ground, additional staff, to do the work that needs to get done so that we can actually build this infrastructure. So picture this, because primarily just of financial reasons, Titus is essentially almost the only real staff member there. Do you want to have a horrific nightmare? Think of this. Think of Brian being the only staff member here at Crossroads. That's a little frightening. And let's get in it.
More frightening for some than others, apparently.
No, but Titus has said, hey, you know, we need some funding so I can hire some great South Africans. And I know there are talented people, some of you, that God may be calling to come over to South Africa and to literally live on the ground, people to be a COO like Darren is over there, to help raise funds, to help run things more operationally, to create a medical clinic where we can reach out to people in Mama Lodi, but also set up appointments where specialists from the U.S. can bring you know, from Crossroads can bring some of their unbelieving friends who may have a humanitarian bone in their body to go over and serve. Business professionals, orphanage parents. This is the next level, we believe, in chapter 3 of this infrastructure. And
all of us in here know that the reason why Crossroads is flourishing is because of our infrastructure. It's because we in here serve and give. There's this real misnomer in America about, man, if I give anything, time or money, I want it to go into a stomach. That's where the best charitable dollars are, put in the stomach. And then we hear all these stories about food being rotted on docks and not being able to be delivered. The most important thing that we feel God has called us to is infrastructure. We mobilize people. We build systems that have ongoing sustainability and are an ongoing blessing. That for us is a core calling, a core competency that we have. And so these are the themes that we're seeing that God's been doing in and through us as it relates to all these different things we're talking about up here and our 12 years of history. Anything else on South Africa?
No, that's
right.
It. That's the vision.
You want to stay up here while Christine goes or take off?
I'll stay.
All right, okay.
Cool. Do you want me to add anything? That's cool.
I don't. Go ahead. Everyone say goodbye to Tim.
Why don't I take off? Like I said.
Well, it's fun for me to hear about South Africa and then have this opportunity to talk about CityLink, because it was those two things that really attracted my husband and me to Crossroads in the first place. I just want to spend some time today just talking about the why of CityLink and then talk about how we're more committed to this than we've ever been before and some of the updates that have taken place since you may have last heard about CityLink. Some of you, you know, besides the fact the Bible talks repeatedly about caring for the poor. Cincinnati has a problem with poverty. Back in August of 2007, the U.S. Census Bureau came out with their latest statistics on poverty. And unfortunately, Cincinnati came out as number 3 for having the highest rate of poverty in the country, right after Detroit and Buffalo.
So the only people we beat were Buffalo and Detroit in the entire country.
It's pretty bad.
Think about that. It's like the Bengals.
So we've seen...
We're like the Bengals of poverty.
That was pretty bad. Yeah. We've seen poverty rates in America go down to 12.3% in 2007. And in Cincinnati, it escalated to 28%. And that's up 8 percentage points just from 2004. And those statistics are in light of a stronger economy. And so we don't know what's going to happen in the future, of course. But when we first started CityLink, we listened to the intuition and the experience of our partner service organizations. And they felt like, you know, to address poverty, one issue at a time was like slapping a Band-Aid on poverty rather than addressing it in a holistic, integrated way. And so we listened to their intuition. We went out to the community and talked to about 100 people in the community, some who would be future clients of ours, and just asked them what values are important to them as we consider something like CityLink. And since then, we've continued to do some additional research. I've had the privilege of working with some amazing women on this development team, and we've got some powerhouse women. We've got a University of Cincinnati professor who has been doing academic research on poverty. We have a woman who is a Six Sigma Master Black Belt with industry experience with Fifth Third and Federated.
Which means an infrastructure guru for sustainability.
Yeah. And so she's helped us to develop this methodology of how we're going to get to CityLink. And then another woman who has been researching best practices on moving people out of poverty and homelessness into self-sufficiency. And my own background prior to coming to Crossroads was in public policy and also in management consulting, developing systems.
You have a master's from the Kennedy School at Harvard.
Yeah.
So we have some fairly smart people that have looked into this and are doing a lot of, you know, stuff that's formalized. And your conclusions about the wisdom of CityLink for our city is what?
Well, I think the research points to the importance of doing things in an integrated, holistic way. We know that we are part of the solution of addressing poverty, but CityLink in and of itself isn't going to drive down the poverty rate. Poverty is a very complex issue, but the research is pointing, you know, we have journal articles saying that multi-service center sites are the trend, and we've benchmarked around 30 organizations that are doing similar types of things, not quite like CityLink, but the trend is pointing in that direction. And so we've got dozens of volunteers, both from Crossroads as well as other churches, who've got subject matter expertise, and they're equipped with the this research, and they're developing systems, systems like case management systems and volunteer management systems and IT systems that will go into effect as we're able to implement CityLink.
Where are we with the court case and knowing whether or not this will happen or
not?
Because as you might not know, may or may not know, we purchased with cash. When I say we, us, churches, other partner organizations, cash, a facility. That's now sitting vacant until it's renovated to what we need it to be. So what's going on with that
now? So the last two court cases, the courts have ruled in our favor, and then the opposition appealed to the Ohio Supreme Court. And so this would be round 5 of 5. This is the last round that could be heard. And our understanding is that the Supreme Court will make a decision on whether or not they will hear our case in the next 1 to 2 months. And then, but they only hear 7% of the cases that are raised to them. On the community front, we've actually made a lot of inroads in terms of developing relationships with folks in the West End. In fact, we had a number of pastors who, initially hearing about CityLink, were opposed to us, but having heard about the benefits of CityLink and in relationship with us, they've actually come across the fence and are enlisting other pastors to join them. They understand that it's going to benefit not just their community, but even their church congregations themselves. In fact, there's a guy named Jim Strayhorn, who some of you have met through Go Cincinnati. We did a couple of projects with them, with Bright Star Baptist in the West End. And he actually participated in the Kingdom Journey last year, and he's going to be one of the churches participating in Consume this year. So that's pretty cool.
That's awesome.
We've also seen similar types of wins with West End Social Service Agencies, similar to the pastors. And we're also in the midst of developing an advisory council that will be comprised of West End community members, community and business leaders. And sort of behind the scenes, you know, we don't have a physical building. That's what we hope to have through Consumed. To be able to invest in the physical infrastructure and the systems of CityLink. But we do have over 150 volunteers who are involved in the ministries across CityLink now. And by that I mean, like, we have a program called The Outlet, where people go down and hang out with homeless individuals on Saturday mornings. We have the Teamworks Job Mentoring Program and Step Up Prison Mentoring Program, and tons of people behind the scenes doing best practice research. And so the ministries are starting to happen now, but I look forward to the day that we are able to actually open the doors to CityLink and think about the people, you know, just experience the kind of welcome that we feel here at Crossroads. Like, Crossroads volunteers there to provide, like, give people dignity and to love people as they come through those doors. So I look forward to that.
Awesome, Christine. Hey, let's thank Christine for doing that. And especially, I know that this was not comfortable. Christine shared something with me earlier where for the other folks who are up here, it'll be a little more comfortable for them to share. But for Christine, she's not the most comfortable public speaker. And I'm not going to tell what you said. Tell me, I heard you were, you're a good public speaker, but she's not comfortable for you. But talk about what
definitely not a comfort zone for me. But when Darren and I got the email that IJM folks were going to be doing a rescue for 25 girls, and risking their lives, I was like, come on, get a grip. You're just going to be talking amongst friends. You can do this.
Let's thank her for doing that.
Huh? Yeah.
Molly, yeah. First of all, director of multi-site. What is a multi-site?
Well, that's a good question. When we were in Crazy Campaign, I remember sitting in a room that was the very sparsely decorated chapel, and Brian talked about, well, what happens if we build a big building and then we run out of space? And he said at that time, you know, well, some churches are learning how to do church in many locations. When I first came to Crossroads, I fell in love with this vision of reaching my friends and having a place to invite them to, that Crossroads would be this welcoming environment. And I have to admit, standing in the back, actually I was standing back with my son so he could see the halftime show, it was the first time that I felt gripped by fear that there would not be room for my friends here. And I have not experienced that for a long time at Crossroads since we were in the other room. This thought that, oh my gosh, what if that person that I've been building relationship with, that's a parent in my son's kindergarten class, decides to show up today? Oh shoot, you know. I'm screwed. Like, how am I going to explain that there wasn't a parking place, you know, or whatever, or a seat? So for me, that was a real point in time that I think God was just gripping my heart with, what happens if we are unable to accomplish our mission here of connecting seekers to a community of growing Christ followers? I mean, I'm about running to my friends. So that aside, when we were on this crazy campaign journey, we were talking about this room and building this building and all that, we said, if we run out of space, then certainly we'll figure out other ways to reach people, because God hasn't called us away from this crazy mission of reaching people and growing people. And so there are some other churches around the country. They've had these problems too. And they've tried lots of different methods. But basically a multi-site church means we're one church and we have different outposts in different places. We're on the same page and we're unified. So
same board, same
everything's exactly. One. And even Brian, unfortunately, will be the same. So if you're trying to go to a site and see me speak instead of Brian, no.
Yeah.
But the point is, God is.
It will be. I mean, most of you don't actually watch me if I'm speaking or whoever's up here. You watch the screen.
Yeah, I've tried to watch you standing here, and it's just really difficult anymore. To do that, I have to watch the screen. I see less of your spit when I watch you up there.
Okay.
That's a little more. But there's this idea that, you know, if God has anointed something, if God has put his hand on something, you know, people weren't shy about walking around with a garment that one of the apostles had touched. And recognizing that God's anointing could be in that thing and could draw people close to Jesus, we are kidding ourselves if we think a video screen is the thing that's going to stand in between us and our friends coming to know Christ. You know, that's ridiculous for us to think that that could be a barrier.
So you could go to a rented facility or someday a permanent facility. People are parking cars or volunteers. You
yep.
have people in kids club. Kids club's happening. You have live band. You've got announcement, community life person, and then you have
a total experience of community
message, yeah.
of Crossroads, and we're one. We're on the same page. Something that is really unique to this community, it's kind of a fingerprint to our community, is how we unify and mobilize people. And with the way we're doing this, that's why we feel like we're doing it, that we can be one, we can be focused, we can have a larger army of people, a larger foundation, like we've talked about, to continue to reach our friends and change our city and change the world. And that's what's so attractive about having more outposts, more sites of Crossroads where we can invite our friends to. The first of which is out in the hinterland, as Tim would say, the northern suburbs. About a year ago, I got invited into relationship with a group of people who were way more passionate about this than me, because they had either moved from Crossroads and they lived, you know, north of 275, or they just lived out there and they made the commitment to make the drive. They kind of banded together and said, are you having trouble inviting your friends to Crossroads? Yeah, I'm having trouble with them. You know, they realized together, wow, there's an opportunity for us to create a location of Crossroads that we can invite our friends to, and we can be the pioneers who do that. And we can lead the charge for Crossroads in this new mindset of how we're reaching people and advancing the kingdom. And it was at that point when I got into relationship with these folks, I wasn't struggling with that. I lived in Pleasant Ridge, you know. I'm like 5 minutes away. I'm like, woohoo, I can invite my friends here all day long. But they have kids who have soccer games. They have, you know, other commitments. And for somebody to take a risk and to come to Crossroads, some of us forget how scary it is to put our foot in the door. We need to remove as many barriers as possible for people coming and experiencing community. And so,
one of them being a 30-minute drive.
One of them is a 30-minute drive. For some people, it might be a psychological barrier, like the river, the Ohio River. You know, for some people, it might be I-75. You know, for others, it could be any number of barriers.
So where are we right now? Because I got to close you out here. Where are we? What's next?
We are working.
I would love
hard.
Folks to have like 20 more minutes to everybody up here. I would. It's deep, and I know you're just getting the surface, but you're getting more than you had before.
Yeah.
So be thankful and like it. So go ahead.
The cool thing is we've got this band of volunteers right now that have already said we're committed to making this thing happen. About 100 strong, which is pretty remarkable considering we haven't talked about this at all, really, very much. They have 500 to 1,200 people that they know they want to invite to Crossroads. So that's one thing. We got this core of volunteers, and we need more. But we also are about 90% there on literally inking a legal deal that will allow us to have a facility to meet in and to launch the first location within the year. So that's the most exciting thing, is that this is not like a future thing for us. We're getting ready to break into this in a powerful way, and we can't wait to talk about the details once it's all sewed up.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Thank you, Molly, for working hard. Awesome. Awesome. So if you've been around for a while, you've heard about the stuff that we've been doing with the slavery stuff in South Asia. We now have found out we can now say India. So it's India. You've heard about that. You've heard about stuff with South Africa for a while. We've got some more flesh on that. You've heard about CityLink, but now you got it in some detail. Now some multi-site stuff. You got a little more information on that. There's a lot more information to share on all those. And over the next period of time, weeks, months, years, you'll hear a lot more about that. But from my personal journey, my perspective, I've known a lot of this kind of stuff heading into my summer study break last summer. And I went into my summer study break and was praying it through and talked with our board and senior leaders. We were all pretty convinced that this year we were going to have another capital campaign. Because this, we talked about up here, this is millions of dollars. Millions of dollars. We don't need any more facilities on this location, but this was a lot of money. So we looked and said, well, first time we did a campaign, it was seven times our annual budget is what we raised over 3 years. The second time we did a campaign, it was five times our annual budget. So either you split the difference, even if it's a bad campaign at four times our annual budget, if our annual budget this year is $9 million, which it is, that's anywhere from 36 to 50 more, $54 million. Okay, that's the answer. Let's do this. So I went away, study break, trying to gear myself up, get ready for this whole thing. And then I had some conversations actually before I actually went away. One of the significant conversations was with Josh Surkamp, who talked about some of the debt load that many of us have and the pressures and temptations. And we started thinking about, do we really want to get in this heroin fix addiction pattern of having some big campaign every 4 years? Nothing wrong with campaigns. God's used campaigns. He'll use campaigns again in the future. But we really have a much bigger opportunity to get our folks, to get all of us free, to not look so much at a new obligation for 3 years, but to say, okay, where am I as far as my personal debt load? Where am I in terms of my personal goals that are just totally unrealistic, that are putting me in bondage? Where am I in my expectations of the things that I should own or the places I am? Maybe the problem is just in the sense of bondage and slavery to the American dream and consumerism, saying no to those things. And instead saying yes to, you can't just say no to drugs, you gotta say yes to something. Instead of saying just no to that, saying yes to the kind of things that were up here. We're not saying no to nice things. We're not saying no to nice houses. We're not saying no to big salaries. We're not saying no to big homes. We're not saying no to, and I'm not saying that no, that any of those things should never happen. We're just saying that there's got to be a sense of wisdom about how much I should be going after those things and what's the cost. I have some statistics for you here. Oh, anyway. Yeah, so I'll connect the dots in just a moment. Here's some statistics for you. This last weekend, 7,000 in 40 minutes. We gave away 7,000 hot dogs, 7,000 bags of popcorn in 40 minutes. Another statistic was at one point we gave 1,100 hot dogs, 1,100 bags of popcorn in 11 minutes. Now, I'm sure it wasn't you. I'm sure you weren't the ones. But people who were handing stuff out learned a lot about the consumeristic nature of people who come to Crossroads. I am serious about this. If you served, you saw a side of people that was really pretty scary. I mean, people like jumping, grabbing hot dogs. They felt like they were grabbing water in the Sahara Desert. People, people berating others that I'm not leaving until you give me 3 hot dogs, I promise my kids. People berating people who are doing popcorn, which was never meant to, like, everyone has a right to popcorn who comes in here, but it was simply meant as an ambiance thing, and people criticizing people that we didn't do good enough planning to have enough popcorn. There's something in us that says, we want it. I want it all. I want it now. We see it in popcorn. We see it in hot dogs. We see it in aspirations for the cars we should drive. We see it in the food that we should be owning and putting on our credit cards. All these sorts of things. And then there's some other stats for you here too. Here's one. We did the keypads a couple weeks ago. Found out a lot of information from that and looked at that information. And here's basically some rough data for you to think about. There's a margin of error that we're not pretty sure of. This is purely what people said. 70% of us in this church make more than $50,000 a year. 70% of us. 36% of us make more than $100,000 a year. 55% of us give less than $100 a month. No, it's actually, I think something like 20% gives like $10 a month or something like that. There's a lot of ways to slice and dice that and interpret that. But here's another way to interpret that. If you look at all this data, and our CFO, Addison Lanier, crunched these numbers, maybe the most interesting thing I've seen for a while, our combined household income, the combined House of Crossroads, we are worth, as a church, with everybody coming, household income, $375 million we all earn a year. Not the Crossroads budget. That'd be really nice. No, all of us, $375 million a year. When you look at what we receive, we get about 2.3% of everybody's offerings, or give, or whatever somebody gives, 2.3% of our income goes to Crossroads. I am assuming when someone gives 2.3% or even 1%, it's a pretty darn good bet you're not giving 8% or 9% elsewhere to come to a tithe. I mean, normally when people have questions, well, should it all go to Crossroads? No, it doesn't have to all go to Crossroads. But normally when someone has an objection about that, they're given like 1% to Crossroads and 0.5% someplace else. I mean, I wish I could have more debates with people who give 8% to other organizations they don't get a benefit from. That'd be awesome. It just doesn't happen in my experience. And so as we look at all this stuff, realize, man, if we could just get all of us to be a little more generous and holistic in the kingdom, if we could all, like, this is not a goal. I have to be very careful how I say this. This is not a goal. This is not a standard. This is not a fair share. But just for perspective, if we, on average, people increase their giving 2.3% because they got out of debt, readjusted their lifestyle, readjusted their attitude towards money. If we, on average, gave just 2.3% more, how much would our budget go up by? 100%, $9 million. $9 million. We would never have to do a campaign again. I'm not against campaigns. We'll probably do another one at some point, but the bigger point for us is to get folks free and say no to things, get all of us saying no to things that we should be saying no to and yes to things that we should be saying yes to. I got an email, Saturday night after somebody came to the Super Bowl service. Here's what they said. I'm deeply offended and greatly disappointed about Crossroads' involvement with alcohol during the Super Bowl event. Some of us were out tailgating. I went out Sunday morning. People were doing, you know, Cokes, waters, coffee. And then one group was doing beers, Bloody Marys. It was a good old rip-roaring time right out there in the deal. And from time to time, we'll get criticism for this. And I've covered this ground before. I don't want to cover it all again right now, but I will say this. I'll say it again. We will do, as a church, anything short of sin to bring someone to Jesus. Anything. Anything short of sin. And we do not believe that responsible alcohol intake is sin. And I believe Jesus did it. That's a whole other message. I don't even want to go into that all that much. But here's what, we've gotten criticism for that, and I actually think it makes sense to get criticism for that, because we need to be very sensitive for those of us who have alcohol addiction problems. We work very closely with our recovery ministry about what is the right policy and how do we do all this. So that's very wise to raise that question. One thing I've never had anybody ask me that I wish they would is something about Crossroads involvement with nice stuff. I'm concerned about that. Like, I've never had anybody say, you know, I come to your atrium and it really causes me to stumble that I see these plasma televisions that I then want to go and buy and put on my credit card. It really bothers me that the Crossroads is putting a stumbling block in front of me like that. No one ever thinks critically about some of our addiction to things. I have an addiction. I have an addiction with nice things. I like nice things. I struggled. I stumbled being in our atrium this last Saturday afternoon when the 5 Toyota trucks were out there. Seriously, I'm like, oh man, this would be so good. I want a little truck like this. I'm looking at the stickers. I'm going from truck to truck, evaluating all the different sticker prices, the towing capacity on one of them in case I borrow somebody's boat and how much they are. And I'm finding out that the person works for Toyota and I can get a discount and I'm comparing this one to that one. They got these, and then I go to one and they got a plasma screen in the back, a flat screen, the exact kind I love to replace my television with. I'll tell you, I look at you. You may as well have had in our atrium a stripper on a pole for me. Honestly. I mean, I think hypothetically I could be in a room where there's a stripper on a pole and not sin. Hypothetically, I guess it's possible. But you put that in a room and, you know, it's going to be a struggle. That's a struggle for me. When I see new stuff like that I can't afford right now, that's a struggle for me. I have that deep inside of me. That's deep inside all of us, but no one's really talking about it because we got to keep America rolling. You know, we've got to, and it's a form of bondage. It's a form of bondage that comes down against us. I want to be free of that. And part of why I want to be, how I'm going to get free of that is just reevaluate holistically. What are my financial goals and how involved I want to be in and stuff like this. So anyway, back to this email. Such a move can be personally and spiritually devastating to individuals like myself. Will your next event involve weed or porn? I think that is sin. So no. I simply don't understand your logic in reaching the lost, reaching people who don't know Christ. Well, it's not logic for us, friends. It's time tested. It's not logic. It's not logic. Thousands have come to know Christ through what God has done in and through our midst. Thousands. It's not logic. It's not a philosophy we can debate anymore. We know in stripping away everything possible, stripping away all that we can and doing anything short of sin, we know that we reach people like us. We know that people grow to places that they would have never gone before. And God uses all kinds of different churches and all kinds of ministries, and we applaud them, we partner with them. Yay. And we also know that how God has called us to function here reaches a kind of person and propels them to a type of growth and propels them to a place in the world that the normal things just wouldn't do. I was reflecting on this, looking at Mark 6 again recently. I keep coming back to this over and over again. I want to read this for us. Jesus left there and went to his hometown accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things? They asked. What's this wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he's performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? Haven't we asked enough questions yet? It's like, why? And they took offense at him. Jesus said to them, only in their own towns, among their relatives, and in their own homes are prophets without honor. Now, here's the big thing. He could not do any miracles there except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. Wait a minute. Oh. He could not do any miracles. They're critical of him. They don't understand his methods. They think that he's one of them, so he's really not special. So they're always questioning. They're always critical. And this created a spiritual climate. And this is why faith is so important. When you don't have faith, that does block something in the spirit realm that keeps things from happening in your life that God wants to happen. It's very hard to explain. I don't even understand it, let alone I can't explain it. But there is such a thing as when you have attitudes and lack of faith, it stops great spiritual things from happening in your life in and around you. And this is even the case with Jesus. It says here, because of all this, he could not do any miracles there. except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. Now, excuse me if I'm wrong, but doesn't that quantify as a miracle, qualify as a miracle? Laying your hand on somebody and healing them, isn't that a miracle? It's not the greatest miracle on God's green earth. The greatest miracle on God's green earth is when one person repents and comes in relationship with him. And not a single person there was doing that. No one was doing that. The miracles that Jesus was most passionate about is when somebody left their life of going after things, going after prestige, going after comfort, going after anything possible except God and turned to him. That is the greatest miracle that God has ever known. And it's the miracle that Jesus is most passionate about. That's the miracle that we excel in. That's the miracle that we go after. That's the miracle that we're ecstatic about. I had a friend of mine who goes to another church, entirely different church. Told me he sent me an email. I don't even know he came here. He came for the Super Bowl, and he was walking out and he bumped into one of the tailgaters there. And there was a guy who said is extremely unchurched, never goes to church. He saw this tailgating and decided to come, and he had a spiritual conversation with him. The very first spiritual conversation he's ever had with him because of the door that was unlocked coming out of some of the humor and some of the stuff that we took place here. That's the greatest miracle that you can ever have. A couple years ago, just 5 or 6 short years ago, we were over in Clark Montessori. And, though we didn't have 3,900 people in a service, we had, I think, 3,900 cars for every service. It was ridiculous how many cars that we would have over there. It was like, everybody was single, seemingly. We had very few parking spaces, and it was so bad. We swear people used to tow their boats just to take up more parking spots. It was awful back then. People park on sidewalks, park on streets, park in people's driveway. There was one family specifically right across or right close to the school that would leave me very nasty voicemails, and Brian Wells very nasty voicemails, and a bunch of neighbors would, because it's understandable that you'd be bummed out your nice bucolic setting in Hyde Park is all of a sudden overrun with parkers all over the place on Sunday mornings. And you're especially bummed out if you're a doctor and you're on call and someone parks in your driveway and you can't get out. Yeah, that would bother me too. This is sort of crossroads lore. Brian Wells and I still laugh about it. We said, hey, we're thinking about buying this property. We were going to try to buy that school at one point and also buy the monastery beside it that is now a conference center owned by Hyde Park Methodist. But we were going to try to own both of those things and buy both those things. We said, well, let's really reach out and talk to the neighbors. And before we do this, let them know what's happening. Pull them in and give them the information about that and all this. And some people say, how come you didn't tell everybody you were going to buy that thing down West End? Well, we learned on this one. Do you do that? You just create more enemies. The people then go, oh, and now I know we're going to do. Now we're going to fight you. But we were stupid back then. So we invite everybody in and said, here's what we're doing. We're going to tell you all the stuff and this and that. And we really were just trying to be open and vulnerable. And we knew parking was one of their biggest issues, one of the biggest problems. So we thought that just to let them know that we want to be a blessing, we said. We know the parking's a problem, so to try to alleviate that, we're going to build a multi-level parking garage. right where the football field is right now, we're going to build a multi-level parking. And they went it was like the masses all rally. They like pulled out their sabers. Parking garage! Ah, to the death! It was wild. I was laughing about this one family in particular were ones we were always kind of at heads with. And again, for right reasons, I probably wouldn't behave any differently myself. That's where I was and people were blocking me in. About a year or so after we were in here, I had a meeting with this family. They called me up and they wanted to just come in and talk with me. And I had no idea what it was about at all. And they basically said, hey, we just wanted to talk and just clear the air a little bit because for the last several months we've been coming here to Crossroads and I just, wanted to talk about that. And they were a very eclectic couple, a very staunch Catholic and a Jew. And this was a place that was kind of prodding them. And so I hadn't seen them. I didn't see them around because there's a lot of square footage and a lot of faces. You can't keep track of everybody. And I find out going on this trip that I just went on to South Africa that, he, the, uh, the Jewish doc, had been to Gilmam Lodi the summer before and was going to be one of the docs that was going on this thing. So we were going to be hanging out for a while. I was like, oh, this is going to be interesting. So, cause he had a humanitarian, but he was a seeker and he had a humanitarian bone in him. He just wanted to love on people and use his ability to be a doctor. And so he was kind of along for the ride and being a blessing. And so one night after we came back from the clinic, he said, you know, can I ask you a couple questions? I said, sure. And after years of coming closer and closer to Christ through various things that have happened here in services, serving, being around you all, you know, you understand, in this room right now, I mean, not all of us are followers of Christ. We've got a lot of people in here who are the most generous people in their time and their money that have never crossed the line of faith. Don't think that just because everyone here is kind of invited to this thing, everyone is over the line. We're not. We're all in different spaces. And it's in being with other people who are in different places than us spiritually, either people who know Christ and people who don't know Christ, that we actually grow. We need to have an eclectic group around us to grow. And so he was growing around Crossroads and doing the various things. And he sat down and said, I just got a couple questions. So I asked him questions and, you know, he had to wrestle through the Messiah piece and a bunch of things that he's been wrestling with for years. And long story short, somebody was up on the balcony and actually snapped this photo of us where he actually gave his life to Christ right here, received Christ right here. How many of us who are followers of Christ would love to have a photo of the moment we received Christ? You know, that's awesome. And I asked him if I could share that, and he said, absolutely. This is what God's called us to, friends. Anything short of sin to bring someone to Christ. Anything. And as we build our team, we see things that we just want to go after and conquer. We want to conquer this AIDS thing and work against it in Africa. We want to go after these girls that are rescued, brought out of sex slavery, but then are not sure exactly where to go with their life. How do they earn money? How do they fold into society? We don't like the fact that God's bringing people to Christ in a city that's number three, the third worst city of poverty in our city, the third worst. We hate that. We don't like that. The old programs aren't good enough for us. The things everybody understands isn't good enough for us. The stuff that people like and approve of that says number three is okay. No, it's not okay with us. That's not okay. It's deep. We have a level of deep ownership for this city. God's placed us here for a reason. These problems are our problems. They're the problems of everybody who aligns himself with Christ, because your actions determine your allegiance. And Jesus is about the least of these, no matter what part of the world that they're in. This is our mission. We connect seekers to a community of growing Christ followers who are changing the world. And as we get more and more globally oriented, we have more and more folks who are part of our team or whose team we're a part of on the other side of Africa, we have some more unique opportunities. Last thing I'll tell you, and then we're going to have communion. And after we take communion, by the way, we're going to do three songs. If you want to stay and worship, great. If you want to leave because you got to go home, that's cool. But this week, we're going to have Polaroid cameras, and we're going to take photos of everybody who comes in, and we're going to give them a photo. It's going to be a lot of money. Every photo we give out is going to be it's a dollar, those deals. It's a dollar. So we've got 10,000 people here this weekend with $10,000 in film. Is going to be given out. We spend money around here in order to make a difference. Here's what we're going to do with these photos. When I was over in South Africa recently, I was struck by the, in some ways, polar opposites of our churches. So many ways were very, very different. The most obvious way is that we have, there's exceptions in here, individual exceptions, but by and large, we have a financially prosperous individual household of a church, and they have a financially devastated individual household church. They also have a spiritual prosperity that we have got to get to. We were over there, and they had a week of prayer and fasting. You ever gone 24 days without food? 24 hours without food? Ever gone a meal without food? Ever gone two meals without food? You know, they'd fast all day, and then they'd have a prayer meeting for a couple hours, and then they actually would eat after that. We didn't know that. I wish they had told me that. I wouldn't have gone 48 hours straight without food, you know, because I go over there and I'm like, I haven't had an extended fast for a while. Okay, well, I'm partnership. I'll go 7. I'm in. So I'm there and, you know, after 48 hours, I'll find out this thing. Oh, that would have been nice to have known 24 hours earlier. But they're into this. Their prayers are powerful. Our folks went over and their 2-hour prayer service went like that. Went like that. And some things started to click with me. And when they come over, we're going to have a week of prayer and fasting when they come over here. And actually before that, they're going to have 6 weeks of prayer for us. See, what's going to happen is I have oftentimes in my kitchen a picture of Tawil, who's a little kid over in Africa that I support through Compassion International. $33 a month. I basically keep him alive and meet his basic needs. Our family. And he's a picture of financial poverty for me, for us, and we support him. We are going to have our pictures sent over to Africa, and it's going to be on the side of huts, on the side of shanty villages, or wherever they are, and they're going to be praying for us, who many of us are in spiritual poverty. They're going to be praying for us because they're in a position of spiritual superiority by their dependence of God, because they can depend on God or we depend on our insurance. They depend on God and we depend on our savings. They find joy in God and we find joy in our Toyota trucks and our flat screen televisions. We look for things to do for us what only God should do for us. And this is for me the next 7 weeks are maybe the most important 7 weeks in the history of our church. It is partially about getting these things done. That's very, very critical. But it's ultimately about getting us out of bondage, getting us to refocus on what actually is financial success. We're not trying to get all of us to use both sides of the toilet paper. We're trying to get us, and I just had to say that, we're trying to get us into a holistic thing that's going to change our life. It's going to change our life and change the world. God, I'm praying that you would just soften our hearts and get us ready for an incredible journey. I think this is going to be one of our most intense and most freeing and enlightening journeys we've ever had. I can't think of another thing I'd rather look at for my own personal spiritual health and the health of the community I'm involved with in this. We want to break our schedules open. We want to break our lives open to look at the nitty gritty and the way in which you've broken yourself open, broken your body and spilled your blood for us. Amen. I'm going to have people who are serving communion come on down front. We also have stations in the back, and I think we still have them up on the top on the first balcony, even though we shut off all the lights. So people are going to come down. You can dip in either the wine or the grape juice, and we're going to worship simultaneously. You want to sing while you come up. You want to go back and sit while we sing more. You want to go home. It's up to you. The body of Christ is open, broken, and spilled out for all who would receive. Yeah, God, we do. We do want filling. We want more. We want more. And for some of us, we're going to find and consume that that means you're going to give us more stuff, perhaps. But for others like myself, who've got plenty of stuff, I want more. I want more of you. I want more grace. I want us as a church to be known as people who want you more than we want your blessings. We want you more than we want your blessings. Fill us up. Fill us up. Fill up this entire building with everybody who comes in here. May they be filled this entire 7 weeks. May all of our small groups be filled. Every heart be filled with your pervading grace. That is enough. Mark this in our history right now, Jesus. Mark this in our history. And as the moment we turn a corner, we sacrifice and empty ourselves for that. Amen. Hey, thanks for coming out tonight. Man, what an honor it is for you guys to come and give an hour and 45 minutes with just getting an email. You're awesome. See you this weekend.